people who are most directly affected by this decision were sitting at the table, part of making the decision.
A new quota for native polar bear harvest in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 11th of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Alaskan who helped with Exxon Valdez cleanup has a warning for Gulf spill workers.
I was constantly sick. It was impossible to complete a day's work without having some kind of ailment to hit me.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
There will be a native subsistence quota for polar bears in Alaska for the first time in nearly four decades. At a meeting in Anchorage this week, a commission that included representatives from the U.S. and Russia set the quota at 58 bears for both countries. The commission was established with a bilateral treaty that was designed to conserve the population of bears who live on both sides of the border. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
High-level government meetings don't usually pack a big emotional punch, but when the polar bear quota decision was finalized after 3 days of talks this week, it was a huge moment for everyone involved.
There were people in the room with tears in their eyes because it has been such a long road to get here.
Rosa Meehan is the Marine Mammals Division Chief with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Anchorage. She says the quota decision was 20 years in the making.
And to finally get there is tremendous.
The quota will allow a take of 19 female polar bears and 39 males each year from the Chukchi and Bering Sea population. The bears roam between the U.S. and Russia. Biologists know very little about the basic dynamics of the population, but they do know the bears are suffering as the sea ice they depend on retreats. Meehan says a scientific working group recommended a smaller quota of 45 bears. The native representatives proposed 68. She says the negotiations were challenging but productive.
The commission had to balance these different perspectives and weave their way through all of it and come up with a recommendation that meets the treaty standard of a sustainable harvest based on reliable scientific information.
There hasn't been a polar bear quota in Alaska for native subsistence since the Marine Mammal Protection Act passed in 1972. On average, 40 bears from the Chukchi Bering Sea population are harvested each year in the state. In Russia, there's currently no legal harvest of polar bears, although poaching is a problem. Charles Johnson is director of the Alaska Nanook Commission and Alaska's native representative on the four-member treaty commission. He hopes the new quota will help get a handle on poaching in Russia.
It's important that the quota be there, and it's important that it legalizes the take in Chukotka, because presently there's no way to enforce the legal use of polar bears in Chukotka.
Johnson says village representatives on the Nanook Commission are unanimously behind the new quota. He says he hasn't heard any negative reaction from other residents in the region, but he says there will likely be some opposition.
There are ways that people might oppose it, but we haven't seen that yet. And there certainly is going to be some idea that, well, maybe we should rethink this, but that's down the road. I think we're going to live with a quota for a while and see how it works.
Johnson says the idea is to share the quota equally between the two nations. Rosa Meehan with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says the logistics of implementing the quota will be challenging. A group of stakeholders will soon begin working out the details of how the quota will be monitored and enforced, but she's confident it will be a success.
There certainly is a strong buy-in to the overall process because the people who are most directly affected by this decision were sitting at the table, part of making the decision. And that aspect, I just can't highlight enough, because that was recognized early on as a key principle necessary to making this happen, and everybody held to that.
Meehan says the quota could be instituted as early as January of next year. The quota doesn't affect the villages of Barrow and Wainwright, where Alaska's Beaufort Sea polar bear population lives, but those communities already follow a voluntary quota system. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
BP may have made progress in capturing the oil gushing from the seafloor of the Gulf of Mexico, but the dirty job of cleanup is only just beginning. As workers flock to the Gulf, one veteran of the Exxon Valdez cleanup in Alaska is warning of chemical hazards. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
In March of 1989, Merle Savage was a 50-year-old newly wedded woman, recently arrived in Alaska from Arizona.
I was a spry 50. I've always been energetic with a lot of energy, and I'm small, 5'2", and I weighed 115 pounds.
She signed on with labor contractor Vico as a Prince William Sound cleanup worker in the early days after the Exxon Valdez ran aground.
And ended up being on the beach, spraying hot water spray with the oil, and it's coming back up in a mist. And so I inhaled it along with everybody else.
She worked hard, caught the eye of supervisors, and was soon transferred from a job spraying rocks to a position as crew foreman on one of the barges that housed the Sound's cleanup workers.
I had a crew that cleaned the rain gear when people would come in every day with their dirty, toxic oil rain gear. They would pull them off and put them in a barrel, and then the next day the crew would clean them with a CitraClean. And that we had to keep using the rain gear over and over because there was a short supply.
As far as she knows, that job was the beginning of a 2-decades-long struggle with health problems. Now 71 and living in the Southwest, Savage says she still deals with respiratory ailments and flu-like symptoms that she says started in the Sound.
I did catch what they called the Valdez crud. And it had flu-like symptoms, bronchitis, diarrhea, upset stomach, throwing up, vomiting. I even fainted. But the coughing was constant because everyone had it.
Savage has a website dedicated to finding Exxon Valdez cleanup workers sickened like herself and is the author of a book, Silence in the Sound.
And when I came back, it was just like everything had hit bottom. I was, like I said, constantly sick. It was impossible to complete a day's work without having some kind of ailment to hit me.
She says her ill health robbed her of a real estate career. She could not work or concentrate for any length of time after finishing her oil spill cleanup job. She credits Cordova marine biologist Dr. Ricky Ott with pointing out that her ailments could be traced to inhalation of oil fumes during that cleanup summer.
I had a liver biopsy, and the doctor had said that I had cirrhosis of the liver. I do not smoke, do not drink, and have never had hepatitis. And he says, well, I don't understand it.
Thousands of people came to the Sound in 1989 to work on the oil spill cleanup. Afterwards, some of them claimed the work sickened them. Anchorage attorney Michael Schneider worked for a time with the Los Angeles firm of Ed Masry, of Aaron Brockovich fame. Schneider's firm gathered histories of sick workers. Schneider says he saw a pattern among the claimants: respiratory ailments, nausea, skin problems. But lack of scientific validation of the cause of the illnesses kept most cases from reaching court. Eventually, efforts to lodge a class action suit against Exxon dwindled and died. Exxon spokeswoman Cynthia Bergman says few people ever filed complaints with the courts alleging adverse health effects from the Sound cleanup.
There were over 20,000 workers, and there were about 50 lawsuits filed against the company. But of those cases, there were no adverse judgments rendered against the company. After 20 years, there is no evidence suggesting that either cleanup workers or the residents of the communities affected by the Valdez spill have had any adverse health effects as a result of the spill or its cleanup.
Bergman says there were no comprehensive health studies done on sick workers at the time.
So many of the cleanup workers for the Valdez spill were transient, temporary workers. So that's part of the challenge of doing any kind of comprehensive study when so many of those workers after the spill go elsewhere.
Today, Merle Savage watches news of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill as the crude spreads from Louisiana to Florida. She says in her experience on the Sound, other than paper masks, there was little protective gear issued to the workers. There was no health insurance, nor did she get any acknowledgement from Exxon.
I have not received any compensation at all for my medical bills or my work compensation either, because I have had to retire at an early age because of my condition.
21 years after the Exxon Valdez disaster, some cleanup workers in the Gulf of Mexico are facing similar effects. The state of Louisiana reports 71 cases of sick workers, according to the Inside Surgery website. Another posting this week indicates that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has listed the carcinogen 2-butoxyethanol as an ingredient in the oil dispersant Corexit. BP has used more than 1 million gallons of the dispersant in the Gulf to date. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And Alaska's Attorney General says the state has settled a breach of contract and professional malpractice lawsuit against its former actuary for $500 million. Dan Sullivan called the agreement a great result for Alaska state workers and retirees. He said it could be the largest such settlement of its kind. The state sued Mercer Incorporated in late 2007, alleging the firm's mistakes had contributed to an $8.4 billion state pension deficit. The lawsuit sought more than $2 billion from Mercer, which had acted as actuary for the state's public employees' retirement system and teachers' retirement system pension plans. Mercer had stood behind its work. A spokeswoman did not immediately respond to an email seeking comment. The case was supposed to go to trial early next month in Juneau. $400 million of the settlement will go into the retirement fund. The rest of the money will cover legal fees and court costs. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new writing center takes shape in Anchorage.
You can be sort of a loner as a writer and yet still pine for connection and still need opportunities to keep learning your craft.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. 90% of those who drown in boating accidents in Alaska are men. To get men to wear their life jackets, have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Go to pledgetolive.org to get a card or find one at your local car Safeway. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety Program.
The 2010 Prince William Sound oil spill prevention drill wrapped up yesterday near Valdez. The State Department of Environmental Conservation conducts spill response drills annually, and industry tanker companies are required to conduct drills every 3 years. This exercise was a multi-agency effort between DEC, the Coast Guard, and Sea River Maritime, the tanker subsidiary of ExxonMobil. Coast Guard Petty Officer David Mosley says, although this was a tabletop exercise, which means a procedural review of communications, wind and wave projections, and response chain of command, recent events highlight the importance of the drill.
The fact that there is an ongoing spill of national significance that's happening in the Gulf brings it to, kind of to stark reality on just how important this type of training is and how much of a difference ongoing training and communications can make in a potential spill response.
Mosley says about 200 people participated in the exercise that simulated a collision between two vessels that triggers a spill. Gary Folly is DEC's on-scene coordinator. He says the drill went smoothly. Folly says drills that involve deployment of equipment are particularly important. Folly says because spill events are infrequent, response equipment hasn't changed much through the years because research and development dollars are hard to come by. He says boom and skimmers work well within limits.
If the seas get much beyond 6 or 7 feet, it's difficult to use containment boom, and it's difficult for skimmers to operate. And in the years that I've worked in spill response, which is actually since the 70s, it hasn't really improved a tremendous amount, I wouldn't say.
The Coast Guard's Mosley says since the 1989 Exxon Valdez spill in Prince William Sound, more than 8 billion barrels of oil have been shipped through the area. Music. shortly after the Anchorage mayor and police chief announced the conclusion of the investigation into Wednesday's shooting of a police officer. Four Northeast Anchorage lawmakers called for the city to increase officer numbers, improve equipment, and change patrol methods. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Aware that this week's shooting of Officer Gene Mills during an early morning traffic stop had rekindled the debate over police numbers and equipment needs, Mayor Dan Sullivan ended Thursday's press conference with a public safety statement going beyond the shooting and Mills' condition.
Meeting last week showed the statistics that show that there's as many officers on the street right now as any time in Anchorage's history. And we were very confident that that police force is highly trained and has good equipment. And the fact that in less than 24 hours, someone who assaulted a police officer was caught, I mean, shows that.
Less than an hour later, Assemblymember and former Anchorage policeman Paul Honeman said despite the fine police work in the Mills case, the mayor's numbers and the quick investigation results do not mean residents feel safe.
Regardless of what numbers we may want to throw out as elected officials and bureaucrats, they're just not feeling safe. If police officers, unprecedented number, two police officers are shot in a six-month period in this city, what about the average citizen trying to commute to and from work? How about when they're trying to recreate or go shopping?
On January 9th, Anchorage police officer Jason Allen was shot and seriously wounded in a yet unsolved drive-by shooting. Honeman was part of a quartet that included Anchorage Assemblymember Mike Gutierrez, State Representative Pete Peterson, and State Senator Bill Walikowski. All represent the northeast portion of Anchorage where Officer Mills was shot. Walikowski agreed public safety is a resident concern.
We have a lot of constituents who don't feel safe in their homes. We have a lot of constituents who are concerned they don't feel safe on the streets. And so as their elected leaders, we felt it was important for us to come out and offer some solutions.
The latest community assessment project does indicate increasing concern about crime, if not specifically personal safety. The 2009 comprehensive report released last March showed of residents surveyed by phone in 2009, 45% said they were very concerned about crime. In 2008, it was 28%. The group agreed with the mayor that Anchorage does have more street officers than ever before, but Walikowski compared police numbers with other similar-sized cities.
APD had a total of about 553 police officers, 408 of whom were sworn officers. Meanwhile, in Buffalo, New York, a city with about 8,000 fewer residents than Anchorage, there were 943 police officers and almost double the number of sworn officers, 800 sworn officers.
Honeman said most cities outside augment their enforcement resources with officers from adjacent communities and or county police. That's not true for Anchorage.
I always love to have more officers per thousand and better equipment and more training.
But Anchorage Police Chief Mark Mew added, until there's money for new hires and equipment and maintenance, he has to run his department within existing financial boundaries.
If the state comes forward with additional money and changes that equation, then I think that probably changes the whole discussion about when we could have academies or how many officers we could afford to employ. So we'll see where that discussion goes.
Peterson and Walikowski said if requested by the city, they'd work to obtain state funding. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Not enough lawmakers yet support a request to call themselves into special session to attempt to override Governor Sean Parnell's veto of an expansion of the Denali Kid Care program. The Senate announced this morning that a poll this week found 11 members wanting to bring the issue before them this summer. The House is not polling its members. It would take two-thirds of the combined membership, or 40 legislators, to call a special session. The bill increasing the eligibility requirements for the service got 15 votes when it passed the Senate this year and 37 votes in the House. Anchorage Democrat Hollis French, who has actively criticized the veto, said the issue is not dead.
The governor made a huge error in vetoing this money that he had supported all through the process, and I think you'll see this issue be raised again and again and again, hoping to make the governor see the error of his ways, and then, of course, we'll get ready to fight to fix this problem next session.
The bill was sponsored by Anchorage Democrat Betty Davis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
The Department of Fish and Game is opening some king salmon fishing on the Kenai River. Catch and release rules will now apply to kings ranging from 20 inches to 55 inches. Fish smaller than 20 or larger than 55 can be caught and kept. These rules go into effect at midnight tonight and run through June 30th. There are restrictions on which areas of the river these rules apply, so anglers are advised to check with Fish and Game for boundary instructions. As of yesterday, nearly 3,500 king salmon had passed the Kenai River sonar station. Escapement goals are for 5,300 to 9,000 fish to pass. If the run continues to strengthen, additional restrictions may be rescinded. The little community of Sutton is gaining almost $2 million in state funds to build a new library. Governor Sean Parnell signed the state's capital budget last week, and that includes $1.7 million for construction of a library building. Nancy Bertles, who has been the librarian in Sutton for the past quarter century, says libraries are more than just places to read.
They mean a place to go to visit with your neighbor in the winter. They are a place to go for cultural activities. They're a place for your kids to, you know, go and have activities with other kids. And there's many other reasons people come here, for permanent fund forms, for weatherization forms, to register to vote, to get their flu shot.
Construction is set for next summer on a new building that will double the size of the current library space. The total cost of the new building is expected to be more than $3 million. About 1,000 people live in the Sutton area. Bertle says reading books is not going out of style there.
Our bestseller list consists of what to grow in your garden, how to build a chicken coop. That's for the adults. For the kids, they like just a myriad of things. And, of course, the Percy Jackson series is hugely popular here, and we just can't keep him on the shelf.
She says parents can encourage their children to read by reading with them and by helping them enroll in library programs. Alaska has its first writing center located in downtown Anchorage. The 49 Alaska Writing Center opened 2 months ago. It offers retreats, workshops, and classes in different writing genres and on the business of writing. Andromeda Romano-Lax is a local author and co-founder of the center. She says they came up with a unique way to help fund the project.
We sort of have a split personality. Not only do we start a writing center, but we started a guest house, because we found out about a beautiful little building that opened up for lease downtown right next to Snow City Cafe. And we call this facility Raven Place. And what we decided to do was create a little place that could be a writing center from October to April and a vacation rental by owner guest house in the summer, as well as occasional dates the rest of the year. And this way, the revenue from our visitor rentals would help pay for some of the cost of running a writing center in Alaska.
And why does Alaska need a writing center?
Well, it absolutely does need that and more. It needs all we can do for the arts, and especially the literary arts. I believe that we have more writers per capita than most states. We just have tremendous storytelling potential and a lot of great writers and a lot of lovers of literature. And I know myself as a writer that in the past, you know, I tended to be a loner, but you can be sort of a loner as a writer and yet still pine for connection and still need opportunities to keep learning your craft throughout your life. I myself went from being a journalist to a nonfiction writer to a novelist to a screenwriter, an aspiring screenwriter. And in every one of those transitions, I needed to learn more and I needed to network and I needed to be inspired. And what we found through the 49 Writers blog is that that's how most Alaska writers are. We love to go to our own corners and do our writing, but then periodically we need to get together and learn and be part of a community. So the blog does a little bit of that, but in terms of offering actual creative writing instruction and inspiring retreats, we decided we needed more of an actual physically located writing center. And then in addition to the physically located writing center, which currently is called Raven Place, we want to develop programming that can travel throughout the state because we don't think that writing instruction should be limited to Anchorage. We think there's resources and programs we can share across the state.
And what, when you're working in the writing community, what types of writing are people doing out there? When you're thinking about crafting workshops, how will they be tailored? Is it more nonfiction, travel writing, fiction writing? What are you seeing?
We have people doing absolutely everything. I actually just came back from a writers' conference in Skagway where I was on faculty and had a chance to talk with a lot of Alaska writers. It used to be that there were more nonfiction writers, essayists, travel writers, nature writers, but I think we're seeing an increase in the kinds and quality of fiction writing. We have playwriting, screenwriting. There's actually been a big burst in interest in Alaska screenwriting in the last year or two, especially poetry. I don't know if I've young adult, children's. I mean, we've got it across the board. There's writers, you know, that people would recognize. And then there's this whole new class of writers, you know, people that have started writing in the last 5 to 10 years that some of us haven't heard of, but they're just really getting started right now. And we have everything from the just coming out of the closet beginning writer all the way to, you know, our wonderful, well-established professional writers and people like our Alaska State writer, Nancy Lord, and I can name a whole bunch of those names. But I think we're actually entering sort of a new golden age of writing in Alaska, and I think things like the internet and new organizations are helping us kind of act and grow as a group.
Andromeda Romano-Lax is co-founder of the 49 Alaska Writing Center. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.